Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome to another episode of GoTo Unscripted. We're here at GoTo Copenhagen in the lovely Denmark, and certainly in Copenhagen. And I'm super happy to be joined by Will. I know it's the amazing Ben Sadegipur. Ben, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for asking. How about you?
No, I'm very good. Thank you very much. Yeah, you've come all the way from California. So is this your first time in Denmark, or have you been before?
First time in Denmark. It's one of those countries that I wanted to visit, but I just never got to. So being here gave me the reason to both visit and come also to the conference and speak.
Oh, cool. Well, I hope at least you've had a Danish when you've been here.
I was the first thing I did.
Yeah, exactly. Scout those bakeries and get a Danish.
There's a few of them behind this venue, so
yeah, exactly.
We became a regular already.
No, good. I'm glad to hear it. So you are VP of Research at Hadrian Security. Is it Hadrian Security?
Yes.
So I live in England. Hadrian's Wall, is that connected with security being something that you break through? Or?
We are, yeah. It's pretty much what we do. We break through things. It's more of a attack surface management meets red team automation. So a lot of like testing, security testing, but also like mapping out what an organization has online, their presence, their websites, their assets. We identify them and then find ways to break into them through automation with working with our platform.
So are you sort of the pen testers in the real world? I mean, your background is being an ethical hacker.
Yeah.
How did that sort of start? And was there a non-ethical before then that, or you've just always been interested in security research?
So I was, how do I say this? I've always done hacking, but I just didn't know I was hacking.
Yeah.
So the story goes, I wanted to play video games. This is something I've always talked about. Like I was a kid, I wanted to play video games. I had an older brother, and it was his computer. And he always had a password on it, some sort of protection, so I can't go on it. And that was my first victim. Learned what brute forcing was at a young age. Didn't know it was brute forcing at the time. But I was one of those kind of computer. And then I found default passwords for Windows. You know, how do I bypass authentication on Windows? Just never thought it was hacking. Eventually, I got into hacking at a young age, but there wasn't any future in it. You know, being a 16-year-old, you don't think anyone's going to want to hire you or anything like that. But then later on, I heard about bug bounties. I have a friend of mine who came up to me and was like, hey, man, like, you should make money from hacking. And I'm like, no, I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to do anything illegal. He's like, no, look up bug bounty. Just go type in Yahoo and the word bug bounty. And I guess Yahoo was one of the first companies alongside with Google and Facebook that were doing bug bounties. And I kind of heard about bug bounty. And, you know, if people aren't familiar with bug bounty, is you find a vulnerability, you exploit and report it to this company, and they pay you for it. And nowadays, a lot of big technology companies, almost every big tech company has a bug bounty program or a way to work with them.
There must be some intense competition for finding bugs in those kind of things. Are you a competitive bug hunter yourself?
I used to be very competitive, but I don't have the energy anymore. But early on, there was a gamification. I was always in the top 10 for both HackerOne, who I ended up working with full-time. Eventually, I got hired by them. And then I was also with Barkrab, one of their competitors. I was always in the top 10. It was I had to stay in the top 10 for a while. But then eventually, I learned, like, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't accomplish anything. It's a good bragging right. It makes you more credible. It gives you more opportunities. But not doesn't mean any. You know, doesn't mean much in the real world other than just gamifying it and making it competitive.
So are there any particular sort of bug bounty programs that you think work really well? Or, and I suppose on the other side of it, if companies are wanting to set up bug bounty programs, what are the good things they should be doing? And what are the bad things that are sort of the wrong incentives? Or, how would you explain that?
But I mean, I think there is a ton of good bug bounty programs right out there. Apple is a big one. Yahoo's a good one. Google has a really, really good one. My favorite ones are, I hacked on Airbnb a lot for a while. I haven't done that in a long time. I enjoyed working with them a lot. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think the way I say it is, if you have an online presence, hackers, well, I don't want to say hackers, cyber criminals and adversaries are always going to hack into your network or your applications. So you might as well just invite the good ethical hackers to work with you. And the first step is always what we call, when it's called a vulnerability disclosure program. That's when it's okay, say something. So you see a vulnerability, you report it, but you don't get paid for it. I'm not saying, I know people are going in the comments and going to come and say, hey, don't do free work. The point isn't to do free work. It's more of a establishing a channel for hackers to work with companies that are not ready yet to pay bug bounty. And I think that's a great place to start because it opens up a place where people, if they, you know, I'm browsing your website, for example, I'm shopping online on your website, I find something critical, I want to report to you, where do I go? Having that established is a very good step.
So is this literally even having an email address on your web page, a security team or something like that, that people can
contact? And also the other one is a couple other things that I would recommend is having an inventory of your assets. So you know what's owned by you, what's a priority for you, what applications have, you know, PIIs or private information for users. Having that understanding is a good one. Also do some pen tests, get rid of some of those low-hanging fruits. It's good for bug bounty hunters. If you don't, they're going to make money, but you want to make sure you understand. You have an understanding of security, but you also have some sort of an internal process to receive vulnerabilities, get them fixed in an appropriate time, because hackers are going to ask you, is this fixed? Is this fixed? So having the two of those would be very, very good. You know, inventory of assets, some testing, and some internal process to handle reports.
When people, I will say, sometimes inevitably do get hacked, they're going to be sort of good responses and bad responses. Mm. How should companies, when they have been hacked, disclose what's been going on? What are the good what are the good things you would like to see, and what are the really bad things you hope not to see?
I can't give you examples, unfortunately, but there's been a lot of recent breaches that happened. Big, you know, giga corporations, huge ones that have been breached. And the first step is just the transparency of it.
Yeah.
Be transparent that this did happen. Don't let the news come out and say this happened. It's always better when you explain. Mm-hmm. Also investigate what happened. And I think the biggest thing for an outsider, for like myself perspective, is it's good when companies are willing to share what went wrong. Why did this breach happen? It's going to come out. You know, eventually it's going to come out in the news. But when they disclose that information, it gives other organizations a sense of understanding of what went wrong or what could have gone wrong, for them to prevent these from happening. So they can put the right process in place, or they can put the right training for their employees in place. I think that's the biggest thing. It's just the transparency and also doing an analysis of what happened and also disclosing it for other organizations to understand so they can prevent it from happening in the future.
Okay. I mean, and even sort of technically, what are the, I suppose, most common kind of vulnerabilities websites do have? I mean, we hear about cross-site scripting and SQL injections and all these kind of things. Is that mostly a solved problem now, or you still find those kind of things? And then what sort of security vulnerabilities should people be looking at, or open doors should people be looking at?
Yeah, cross-site scripting is still a thing. Unfortunately, I don't think it's ever going to go away unless we find a way to not take like user input and user data.
I don't think
it's going to go away. I think it's more common with legacy sites. A lot of the bigger organizations that have been around for years, I think they're more prone to have them. I think the more, I don't want to say it's completely fixed, but the more modern stack technologies are, they use libraries and they use other third-party things to prevent cross-site scripting, but it still happens. I'd be surprised to say it never happens, honestly. That's a really big one, but depending on, I think with today's technology, it's harder to exploit. You have, you know, things that are in place that could prevent it. People have other ways of handling cookies and things like that. The other two big ones is something that I really, really did a lot of research and really enjoy is a vulnerability called server-side request forgery, which pretty much allows to use your application as an internal resource to talk to things that are behind a VPN, for example. So it's gated in another network, but because this application speaks to it, if they hack into this application, they can also speak to these other services. So I would give an example for AWS. If you have an instance on AWS, you can query metadata where your keys are stored, for example, that gives you access to other applications. Or it could be that you can talk to some other microservices behind it, or stuff that are supposed to be internal. And you can find those in anything, any integrations, any webhooks, PDF generators are a big one and a fun one. I did a year of research on those, which was really, really cool. And it's just the possibilities of things you can do with an SSRF is just unlimited. You can either command execute, you can query data, you can speak to services. It's just incredible what you can do with it. To name a few companies, I think Snapchat, Lyft, Verizon Media were some of the recent ones that I found these vulnerabilities in. And then the third one is an insecure direct object reference, IDOR. That's where it allows you to pretty much, if you go to like the API, so when you query your profile, it's going to go to the API. It's going to say, hey, here's my user ID. Unfortunately, a lot of cases that user ID is an integer that's incremented by one for every user, right? So I'm user one, user two, three, four, five, six, right? And all the way to like a million. And if you change that ID and the API call from 1 to 2, in some cases, it may give you, in most cases I've seen it actually, the user information for the other user. That alone isn't a vulnerability, but in some cases that API call could be, you know, user ID slash address that gives your entire address. It could be there, you know, for, let's say for an example, a shopping site. It could be everything you have bought. It could be a receipt. It could be an invoice, right? It's invoice slash 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I go through and I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. And that gives me your address, what you have bought, your last four, your credit card number, and all those like PII. So that's a really big one that I still see to this day. It's more of an authentication authorization issue, but it's still very, very common nowadays in the modern days application.
So is there any API design stuff that people should be thinking about? Because one is authorization, authentication, once you're in, but you know, people are wanting their APIs to be simple to consume, but then it maybe does make it even easier to be able to traverse these paths and guess slash invoice slash details or that kind of thing.
There's a lot. I mean, the big one is just authentication, authorization. Don't assume that you're handling things. It gets even messier when it's like organizations, because then under organizations, you have like different user roles, different, you know, users. They're always, the assumption is because they're gated, they can't speak to each other. That's not the case, really. You just have to traverse either, you know, organization and then brute force for the next user ID. Other than that, there's a ton of different things. I think one would be not assuming just because a functionality isn't visible in the user interface, it's not accessible or discoverable.
Security by obscurity, yeah.
Yeah, it's just because you're not visibly showing the users this functionality, it doesn't mean that I can't find it through your JavaScript files, for example, or that I can't just brute force for it, guess the folder file name for it, right? Those are the two big ones. And also how you parse data when a user's sending you data, how are you sanitizing that data?
Yeah, so you use the sanitization in the function or the code as soon as it's arriving, or even on the API, I suppose. There's a lot of API products have hopefully robust user sanitization, or use at least a mapping template that you need to go through to check that you're not sending some strange stuff.
Yeah, and then just not assuming things. Yep. Just not assuming that, you know, already been checked, already been secured, whatever that is. The assumption is the biggest one.
Does cloud make any of this security simpler, or does it make it complicated, or is it, I presume it's also more nuanced than this, that it can be both?
I think it can be both. I think it makes it secure because they give you more tools to, you know, make these things secure, right? Like, you know, when you're, for example, using AWS, you have all these different things that could help you protect your application, your users' data. But at the same time, if they're not gated properly, one application gets hacked. If you haven't separated them by the keys, by the user roles or the IAMs, then everything, you're pretty much giving them the keys of the kingdom. And you'd be surprised how many times that's happened. You know, when I hack into a company, I get some sort of keys for them. I have access to everything because, whoops, they forgot to, uncheck that one box. But it's a bit of both. They give you the resources, but it's also very complicated. There's like so many resources and all these different micro apps that you can use, but then the user is confused. How do you use every single one of them? How do you make them talk to each other? So I think it does a little bit of both.
Yeah, and I suppose that comes back to what you were saying before, having an inventory of all your resources and what you have. So at least you know what you need to protect rather than just flying blind and, you know, just protecting your API. You need to step back from that and have protection mechanisms for your data, whether that's at risk or in flight, and how it's stored and how it's accessed as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, I think having that inventory helps you know what's at risk, and having the way of prioritizing it also helps to know, you know, these are the applications that could be either very vulnerable, or it could be, you know, very important to an adversary and all that stuff. It's just having an overview map of things to take a look at is also very, very important.
So if somebody is keen on getting into the ethical hacking business, I know you've got a workshop and you help people to do that. What are the sort of things they should start? Or should they just be, you know, opening the US Department of Defense's webpage and just, you know, going straight in there and seeing what they can, how they can get in?
I think that depends on the person's knowledge. It's where are you in your your studies, for example? Where are you in your career? I think it's easier to make that jump from a development perspective to ethical hacking because you kind of know how things work. You've built, you know how to build these things. It's now, how do I break them? So if I throw terms at you, it's easier for you to understand because you understand as a developer, not as a hacker, right? So that's a big one. There are a ton of online resources nowadays. Some of my favorites are TryHackMe, HackTheBox, Pentester Lab, ctfchallenge.co.uk is a really good one. Bugbountyhunter.com. It's all these different resources. Depends on your style of learning. I would say, you know, enroll in those. I think it's like 10, 12 bucks a month. In some cases, they're free. Burp Suite, it's a tool everyone uses by Portswigger. They have a free version, WebSec Academy. Go through those and learn the basics. But you're absolutely right. Once you've learned the basics, the best way to do these is just to get your hands on the keyboard and actually start to hack and to learn. And I think the best way to do it is I personally recommend for new people to go look at vulnerability disclosure programs. These are programs that don't pay you, but it gives you an idea of how things work. So you can build your own methodology on how to hack. And there's a why I say that is a lot of the top hackers are going after bug bounty programs that pays. And there is a lower chance for you to find things in your early days because you're still learning. So I always recommend starting with a disclosure program and then making your way up.
And I suppose you were saying that, you know, there's got to be an interest and a passion to find and discover things. You know, people saying that programming, you know, 80% of programming is putting bugs in and then the other 80% is taking bugs out. Yep. So, I mean, as people are developing in their IDEs or in the cloud or, you know, JavaScript, Python, Node, whatever, you know, Java, whatever language they're using, you know, the whole handling of bugs is part of the development lifecycle. And I suppose this is just now taking it another step. And instead of troubleshooting and, you know, finding your own bugs, you're finding other people's bugs. But that takes time. I mean, programming is not just sitting in front of a keyboard and just, you know, learning how to type or something. There's a lot of skills required in programming. So what kind of skills should people be thinking of if hacking and, you know, finding bugs is of interest? You know, how can people get better in their programming skills?
I think the big one is just programming is a portion of it. I don't like code, but I understand 10% of most languages. Like, I can kind of understand what's happening behind the scenes. The other one is I think learning how to Google is a big one. I think 90% of my job is Googling things, like even some very, you know, basic things. I've learned that knowing everything by heart isn't going to get me far. Yeah. I just have to know how to Google for it. And knowing how to look things up efficiently to be able to find the answer within 3 or 4 Google queries is a very, very big, I think it's a very good skill, to be honest.
Time saver too, yeah.
It saves you a lot of time, absolutely. And also, I think the biggest thing is understanding that no matter if you're a developer, you're a hacker, whatever it is that you're doing, that it's a never-ending learning journey. You're never going to stop learning. It's not that, okay, today I know cross-site scripting, SSRF, IDOR, I'm done, I can go make money. No, those things become harder to find, new techniques come out, you're every day challenged and pushed to learn new things, and being open to that is a big game changer. It's the same thing with development, right? Like, PHP was a big one, it still is, but you have all these different new languages that have came out recently that are more prominent that people use that you have to, you know, learn and keep up with. It's the same thing, you have to make sure you're open to learning every day.
I suppose there are two sides. We've been talking about sort of red team kind of stuff where you are, you know, finding the vulnerabilities, but there's a whole other sort of blue team kind of stuff where you're defending against the vulnerabilities. I mean, is that two sides of the same coin, just different kind of skills, or how do you think about that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, blue teams are more the exact opposite of each other, blue team and red team. Red team, you're breaking in. Blue team's job is to catch you and mitigate things. It's pretty much, yeah, there are two different sides of it. I think as a blue teamer, you're more on the defensive side. How do I quickly catch these folks that are hacking in? How do I prevent it? And if you have a red team background, it helps you a lot more because you can think like an adversary. But red teaming, with the stuff that I do at least, I'm not a red teamer really. I wish I was a red teamer. I'm not there yet at least. But with a lot of things that I do to bring into a company, I'm not too worried about what the blue team is doing. I mean, especially with bug bounties, because I don't care if I get caught, right? With red team, they don't want to get caught. They want to stay and they want to like elevate their access and go through the entire process. But for someone like me, I don't really have to worry about the defensive side, but it helps when I know how a developer thinks. Can I guess what the thought process was when they were writing this piece of code? So if they're running an uploader for you can upload your images, what are some things they thought about to put in place or prevent it that I could break out of or exploit for my own good?
How should people think about if they are hacking something or connecting to something? There obviously are ethical concerns and moral concerns, and I'm not just talking about a company losing money because you've managed to stop their payment gateway or whatever. But I mean, there's personal information out there, there's private information out there. You know, there are hacks where power stations and power grids are being shut down. You know, is there a line that can be crossed, or is it just people being inquisitive? We've got nation states, pouring billions into hacking. I mean, this is big, big, big business, which as IT gets more prevalent, is just going to get even bigger.
I think there's always a line you should not cross. So, for example, with my case, I can't talk about stuff like SCADA power grids because that's a complete effing ball game. It's, when you have access to like an electrical thing that could bring the whole grid down,
yeah,
there, you shouldn't cross that line. You're like, see, oh, can I flip this switch? That's a complete different thing. But when it comes down to like your PIs or information, yeah, there is a line. Proof of exploitability, like if I want to prove that this is a vulnerability, do I query 3 or 4 users? Or do I query the entire database of users that this company has, right? That's the line that you decide to cross. If I'm already in an internal server, if I've already breached into the internal access, in the internal network, there is a line, do I go and dump the database or do I just prove that I can dump the database, right? I don't have to actually do it, but I can say, hey, I have access to this thing that could potentially dump the database. I think ethically, it's just knowing, I think at our core, we all know what is right or what is wrong. And it's just choosing to go with your gut feeling of, if there is a question of, should I be doing this? The answer is always no.
Yeah.
If you're questioning it, the answer is no, but it's just more of a, how do I justify that I want to do this?
And it can be exciting, I'm sure. If you're getting further, deeper into something, it can be exciting. You've got access to more data. You want to keep going, but you've sort of made your point and you sometimes take a break, have a coffee, and then think about what you're doing.
There's been a few times when I've been in an internal network of a big retailer in the US, and there was almost anything that I wanted to access was unauthenticated. It was very tempting to go, I wonder how much more damage I could do with this. And there's been times that I've asked companies like, hey, I have this like assumption that I could do X, Y, and Z. Could you let me try them? And some companies are open to it. A lot of cases, they're not open to it. This company was like, no, our SOC team is already very unhappy about what you're doing. Can you just drop it? But I mean, there is always that, I wonder what else I could have done, or like, I wonder how bad this breach could have been, especially when it's like a big, big organization, right? When it's like I use Lyft as an example. It's a company that I've publicly worked with. There's been a few times I'm like, I wonder what else I could have done with this, but I will never know.
Mm. Sort of flipping it around, what can people do to protect their private information and to, as more of our lives become online, our addresses and children's information and school things and everything and work information and, medical information is all out there. What can people do other than just battening down the hatches and not posting anything online? Or is that what you should be doing?
I mean, realistically, that's probably the solution, but also not realistic because
you need to live online. Yeah.
We all live online in today's age. I think it just comes down to, do you really need this website? Like, do you have to give them your information? If you're shopping online, obviously you have to give them your address because then how are they going to deliver something to you? You don't have to always give them your real address. In a lot of cases, I just go 123 Test Street. They don't need to have my address if they ask for it. You're not going to send me anything. You're not sending me mail. We don't need to talk. So you don't have to give them information. That's a big one. But also, I think the majority of people, that's the biggest issue, is just the security hygiene. A lot of, especially with the older generation, that the internet's new to them, they're still not familiar with what to do. It's just educating people, even at a young age when they get into computers, like how do we educate them so they protect themselves online? But also showing the older generation how to do these things as well. The biggest one is like password management is a big one. It's always, you know, I joke with my friends, they're like, oh, don't look, I'm going to type in my password. I'm like, let me guess, it's like your dog's name plus like a number.
How do you know?
And that's the reaction, yeah. Right? It's like, oh my God, did you know my password? I'm like, no, but thank you for the reaction because it shows me that you, just like everybody else, you're human. You're going to put your wife's name and the year you guys met. That's like the password for most people. Educating them, like, hey, make it something else. Make it a sentence. Make it, you know, instead of I love my wife, make it I love my wife because X, Y, and Z. So it's something a lot more random than just knowing their name and their year of birth, because that information is always online. And not using that data that could be, you know, scraped online about you and, you know, security questions or passwords and that kind of thing.
So how do people put enough variety in their passwords that ultimately you want a unique password for every site? But, I know plenty of people who would find that very difficult to do it. So is it a long password using a sentence? How would you add some variety in to make it unique for sites? What sort of tips?
I would say use a password manager. Password managers do that for you. All you have to do is remember 1Password. I don't know, there's a company called 1Password. You sign up for them, they manage your passwords. People are like, what if they get hacked? It's a lot harder to hack into a company that's invested in protecting your data than a lot of corporations also use. Then like hacking you is a lot easier. So use something like that, and then you have to remember that 1Password that you just have to remember. That's going to be hard. It's something that you're always going to remember. And they create passwords for you based on every site. And it's very easy to use on your laptop, on your computer. It's very easy to use on your phone. You literally, it's like your regular phone. It's a Face ID for an iPhone. It asks you what app you want to use. You click on your password management and it logs you in automatically. There's 2 steps you have to take, but those 2 clicks protect you from getting your account hacked. So if the next big breach happens and your password was in that breach and you use that password for your bank, for your social media, for your email, I have access to everything. All I have to know is what is your email address and what bank do you bank with? And it's not hard to guess those banks, because let's be real, in every country there's 5 or 6 banks that are major, right? And it becomes easier. 2-factor authentication is a big one. People tell me, like, don't say 2-factor, you should do multi-factor, you know, like, don't do the SMS one, do apps. I'm like, someone that's like my mom's age or my dad's age, their threat model is different than you and I, right? Like, no one's gonna go and SIM swap my mom to get to their bank account. Like, they're gonna give up, but for me, it's a different profile. But having that, I'd rather have someone like, you know, my parents or my elders, like, I would rather have them use a text message 2-factor authentication than not use one at all. I get the argument on why you should do one or the other, but it's just more of a having that in place, like a good place, because it protects them. It's an extra layer of protection. Even if you're using, you shouldn't be using the same password, but if you're using the same password over and over, at least you have that layer of protection when they text you your 2-factor authentication to log into your account.
People at GoTo are, you know, developers and IT professionals, are there better things that they should be doing? Because a lot of IT people have full admin access to, you know, a lot of systems when they're developing code. Maybe they've got protections in CI/CD pipelines that have separate accounts or separate usernames and passwords or access keys. But a tip or two for IT professionals to improve the security posture of their companies?
One is the obvious one. Personal passwords and work passwords should be different. I think the training is a big one. Train people not to click on links. It always starts with the more entry-level positions at the company, and they can always elevate up. It's just the security hygiene of like the things you do personally, but also doing them at a bigger scale with your company. I think education is a big part. I don't think we spend enough time educating people why security is important. Always the question is, who's going to hack me? You would be surprised. You're not the primary. You are a part of a bigger grand scheme of like plans. Those are probably the biggest ones. Phishing and, you know, whatever ishing you want to say, phishing, there's like a bunch of different variations of it. Training for those is a big one. You get a phone call, and I've gone as far as like when my bank calls, I ask them, confirm you're my bank. How do I know that you just call me from a number? It's a 1-800 number. How do I know that's a real number, right? Training for those things is a big one. Someone calls you and says, hey, I'm calling from your IT department. How do you verify? Hang up and call them back, or have some sort of a 2-layer protection where they can confirm that this is in fact who they say they are.
Yeah, and I suppose also taking control of yourself. I mean, I know you get scam calls and it's from the tax office saying, oh, you owe us lots of money, and it's a, you know, heavily accented English recorded message, and that's just obvious that it's somebody else. But I know other people who have been called and that they have got the right bank, and they do assume it is the right bank, and to never be rushed into making a decision or transferring money or doing anything like that.
Yeah, it's a, and they're getting better and better.
Yeah, as, yeah.
You know, they're getting very much more accurate. You know, the background noise sounds so real. Even there's like a YouTube video in the background playing. But yeah, it's the biggest one is just not assuming the zero trust. It's just having zero trust that whoever's on the other side isn't telling you the truth. I'll give you an example. A hotel called me recently and like, hey, you have, we want to give you this deal. It's a very good deal for like a 6-day vacation for very cheap. And I go, okay, this is a scam. And they're like, no, it's not. I'm like, I don't believe you. Can you confirm? I made this lady go, give me her phone number to call. And I was like, hey, I need you to tell me to go on this website. What is your website? So you can go on it. It was like a big hotel brand. And she's like, go to our website, click on the link down below, go to this number that's on the screen on the website. I need you to call them and confirm that my name so-and-so works at this company. Here's my extension number. Put her on pause. Call on the other side. Like, hey, I'm looking for so-and-so. Can you confirm? The lady was like, yep, I'm the manager. I confirm that this person works for us. So I went back and was like, I apologize, but I'm just getting one too many scam calls. And you're asking me to not only give you X amount of dollars, but you want my credit card number and you have my phone number. And like, I have to confirm you are who you say you are. Mm. I wouldn't shy away from it. You know, if you're spending money, you're spending $1,000 to go to this vacation, the least you can do is put them through that process of proving they are who they say you are. They are for your own protection.
And I suppose turning that around, customers, companies must set themselves up that they can be contacted. And without giving private information about all the employees, there must be a way in that somebody can verify who works there and what's legitimate.
Yeah, but even you can't even trust the fact that it says, like, can you confirm, you know, you work for the company? Because how are you going to confirm that, right?
Yeah.
Like, can you give me my address?
Who do you phone? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, like, can you tell me my address? They can find that information on you in some cases. So just verifying the data on your own is always the best bet.
So just coming back around to what we started about sort of career and hacking, I know you run a course. Is that, I'm sure that's a really great way that people can at least get interested in ethical hacking. What are the details of that? How do people find it online?
Yeah, first of all, like if you want to learn things, the course isn't always the way. The reason why I say that is I think today's age, almost everything you want to learn is found online. The reason why I've created a course is more of a, people ask, like, we want to learn from you. How do you approach these things? So if you want to learn my approach to hacking and bug bounties, the course is very valuable. But I highly recommend doing some research on the, you know, at first before you purchase the course. The course is called Intro to Bug Bounty and Web Hacking. Right now it's hosted on Udemy. It's just easier to host than anywhere else. Then I go to conferences and present it. And we could always look for it. It's online, you know, it's not that expensive. We can look for it on Udemy, it will pop up. And there's also, if people want to look for bug bounty resources, if you're typing bug bounty resources, literally the three words, the first thing should be a GitHub repo that belongs to me to have all these different resources, including my course, some other free applications, websites, books, all those things that they can use as well.
Excellent. How else could people contact you on? Are you on social media? How would people get in touch if they have any questions?
I am on all social media except Snapchat. I make it a point to say this.
Oh yeah, is there a reason for that?
Not really. It's just funny to say because a lot of kids use it, so I just go. I'm on every platform except Snapchat. it's always the same thing. I go by Nahamsek, NAHAMSEC. So at Nahamsek, I'm on Instagram, Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter. I have a YouTube channel, Twitch channel. People can tune into it, hear from me.
Excellent. Well, Ben, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for joining us on GoTo Unscripted here in Copenhagen. It's amazing to be able to talk to some of these amazing speakers who've got such super interesting information in beautiful Copenhagen. So until next time, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.